figure. Thanks a lot for this nice introduction. I hope this is also recorded. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit today about the collective motion of active particles. And well, since this is a relatively small audience, I'm very happy if we have discussions during the talk. I also want to start with a very brief introduction, because I think we have all seen swimmers in all shapes and forms a lot in the recent weeks. So just a very brief reminder, there are many examples for these microswimmers and self-propelled particles. I have here only a few of the biological kind, but of course there are also many artificial microswimmers by now. I'm showing you these examples because I will come back to them in the next few slides with our simulation. So this is a bacterium swimming with a bundle of helical helices. These are sperm cells moving on the surface of an egg. And this is Paramecium, Pantoffeltierchen in German, because it looks a little bit like a slipper. And it's propelled by these little hairs on its surface. I think it's slippery because can imagine of slipping in here. Okay, and then there are many interesting examples. Again, I'm a very small selection. These here are sperm cells swimming at the surface of a cover slip. At higher density, they actually organize into these little vortices, which you can see in some magnification here. And these are the cilia on Opalina. It's also kind of an animal similar to Paramecium, and you can see that it forms these little waves, which are called metrical waves. Now, what I want to do in my talk, I want to give you a very brief overview of what we have done on biological microswimmers, but then really focus more on some more theoretical system or colloidal particles, which are self-propelled rods, self-propelled spheres. And I will also tell you something about circle swimmers. So this, what I'm showing you now on the next few slides, is just a brief overview. And if you have questions now or after the talk, then I'm happy to discuss them. So I just want to show you briefly what we did on the bundling of bacterial flagella. So that is motivated here, of course, by these nice movies of Howard Berg, where you can see that the bundling, the bacteria do this run and tumble motion. I will tell you a little bit about the formation of metaconal waves and then say something about spermatization to surfaces. And as I said, this is really more an overview. Okay, so very briefly, so this is our model for the helical flagella, and our interest is to see the synchronization and bundling when we start with such a bundle where all the helices are in parallel, and then they start rotating, and how does the bundle actually form? I can show this as a movie. No movie. So here you see the helices from the side, and this is from the top. And note in particular, this little line here, that's the initial phase angle. So you see these two are actually in phase, and this one is 180 degrees out of phase. Now let's start this. Yeah, see, they are synchronizing very quickly. They're in synchrony now, and then slowly they are winding around each other and forming this bundle.
So this is the same simulation, some kind of bead model?
Yes, the beads here are showing short-range repulsive interactions. In addition, there's a bending and torsion potential to make this thing helical. So the equilibrium shape is a helix of each of them. But then it has some flexibility, it has a bending and a torsional rigidity, and therefore they can deform a little bit.
And how are they interacting with each other?
Well, the whole thing, sorry, I should have mentioned, the whole thing is embedded, I'll say a little bit more, in a mesoscale simulation, mesoscale solvent, so that there's hydrodynamic interactions between them. But I mean, if you had no hydrodynamic interactions, they are sufficiently far apart, they would just not see each other. So it's actually each of them, as it rotates, sets the fluid around it into a rotational motion, and this is what the other helices feel, and that's why they are somehow circling around each other.
Is it Stokes flow interaction?
I mean, we try to make the velocity small enough and the viscosity high enough that it's Stokes, that we are in Stokes regime. So, this is a particle-based simulation method. I say a few words about it afterwards. Maybe I should have started with it, but anyway.
But anyway, so these beak particles, is this like those rod simulations we talked about last week, where you impose that these beads sit on some specified object?
No, this is flexible. So this is like a semi-flexible polymer with a bending rigidity, but in addition it has this somehow the torsion angle, these angles relative to each other, so that the equilibrium shape, the shape at zero temperature would be a helix.
So this
is the shape here at rest.
But so is it a discrete set of flexible beads. Links between the beads?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so what you see here, these the beads are from a hydrodynamic point of view, the beads are just point particles, and they just interact with each. So they generate this hydrodynamic interaction with the fluid. As I said, let me come back to the hydrodynamics in a second. Okay. And so one of the results we find here is the. This is difficult to read, sorry, that the synchronization time and the bundling time, somehow how long does it take for the phases to synchronize and how does it take until the bundle has completely formed? And we find that as a function of the distance here between the anchoring points, here the distance between the anchoring points, we find that the synchronization time increases linearly, sorry, there's something wrong. This should be a d square. The synchronization time goes like d square, and the bundling time goes like d.
You're going to tell us your precise definition of synchronization and bundling.
Difficult. I mean, as I said, I'm happy to tell you more about it, but it's not straightforward, right? Because I mean,
because the synchronization is never going to be perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, synchronization is easier because, I mean, you see, you start with 180 degrees. After a while, you are close to zero. That's relatively well defined. Bundling time is more difficult to define because it depends actually where you are on the helix. So, I mean, we say essentially until the end has really come to a coherent motion. That we call the bundling time. Okay, so then the next thing is, of course, if you think of this run and tumble motion, one part of the run and tumble is to form the bundle, the other part is to unbundle, that one of the helices actually leaves the bundle, and that's what we do by taking different torques for the different helices. So that's essentially the same model which I showed you, but now we say the helices 1 and 3 have a torque of 400, so that's this one, but the second helix can have a different torque. And then what you see here is a phase diagram as a function, again, of the distance between the helices, the base distance between the helices. And what you see in the phase diagram are three different regimes. One where you have phase locking, that's the green part, so that means the helices are bundled and they never unbundle and they always rotate with the same phase. Same frequency. In this black region, so why is this black now? Okay, anyway, in my thing this is yellow. So this region is yellow, that's why this is also yellow and unreadable. This is the phase slip region, so that means they are bundled for a while, then one of the helices leaves, rotates one additional turn, joins the bundle again, then they are rotating together again for a while, then one leaves again and so on. Yeah, so that is this black-yellow region, and then finally here for the red region, then one of the helices helix 2 permanently leaves the bundle, rotates with a different frequency, and someone never joins the bundle again. Yeah, what we found interesting is that this region here where we have phase locking or maybe even phase slip is actually very wide, right? I mean, you can see here if you have a torque of 400 of the other two, then you can at least vary the torque of the other helix by 50%, and still the bundle essentially keeps together. And we have the feeling that this is important for the run phase of bacteria, right? Because, I mean, the helices will never be exactly the same, the motors will not be exactly the same, so they should sustain some torque difference in order to keep the bundle intact.
I don't know if you looked at it, presumably there's a similar robustness if you vary out the torque, but the exact geometry of the helix, if it's longer or wider.
I mean, we have not really looked at this, and this is a little bit related to this construction of the helix we were talking about, because I mean, because of this bending energy and the torsion energy, I mean, if this becomes too, I mean, if lines become too straight, then a little fluctuation can somehow throw them off balance, and then it's very difficult to regain the shape of the helix. But I mean, I think this is due to the I would say not optimal construction of our helix. I mean, I think we can do better. I mean, Holger used the model for, which is more of a worm-like chain model with, I think that is more stable, and I mean, we are more looking in this direction. But that's the reason we have not really looked at the geometry of the helix. And also the bending parameters and so on. I mean, I completely agree with you. This is due to the winding around each other. Yeah, and therefore, the bending rigidity obviously has an important role. I mean, if that would be very rigid objects, I mean, this would not happen. Then this region would be much more narrow. I mean, actually, there has been an experiment and also some calculations for colloidal rotators, which are rigid. So that's just some little wheels, if you like. And they desynchronize already at like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4 torque difference. So they have this phase, also the phase slips and the drift, but the drift sets in already, as I say, I mean, at a tiny difference in the torques. Okay, so that was about bundling. Now the next thing I want to briefly mention is cilia and metachronal waves. So we make this construction here to mimic the beat of a cilium, which where you can see that, I mean, this is from the side, this is from the top. You can see that it has this power stroke now and the recovery stroke, power stroke, and so on. That, as I say, I mean, this is not exactly how it looks like for a real cilium, but I think it mimics the main features. So what we need to generate a metachronal wave is this active elastic filament, which I've shown you here with a power and recovery stroke. We also need some feedback, right? I mean, the cilium has to somehow be able to react to the flow field or to the behavior of the other cilia around it. Otherwise, it will not be able to to self-organize into some structure. And this we do by this geometric clutch, which means the cilium beats in one direction until it hits a threshold, it hits a particular geometry. When we say, okay, then when this is reached, then we switch to the recovery stroke, and similarly the recovery stroke proceeds again until it reaches another threshold on the other side. Yeah, then depending on the flow, the power stroke or the recovery stroke may be slower or faster because it's held by the flow field or opposed by the flow field, and that will slow down or increase this particular phase. Yeah? And then, of course, we need, again, hydrodynamic direction, and we also have some inherent noise, which I think is nice or important because we have to see whether this wave which is forming is actually stable with respect to noise or whether it's just some very small region in the parameter space. So let me just show you this movie. So we start with all cilia in phase, and then you see that due to the noise, they quickly, but this quote a small noise, but the initiates that they start to beat out of phase. And then after a while, you see that metachronal waves start to form. Yeah, maybe now you can start to recognize some of them. Maybe look a little bit here in the back, then they are more easy to to see.
So is the fluid these guys are moving in extending up to some very large distance?
It's not a very large distance. Actually, I can't even remember, but maybe there's another. They are mounted on a no-slip wall. There's another no-slip wall, which is about a factor two or three away from
two or three times length
of the ceiling. Okay, and then the last example I want to show is this is sperm moving close to surfaces. And so what you see here, this is a chiral sperm. It moves in the bulk on a helical trajectory. And then when it touches the surface now, yeah, it starts to move in. It stays at the wall. Yeah, you see it never swims away, and it swims in circles. And that is what's actually seen in experiment. Now, of course, an interesting question is what actually keeps the sperm at the wall. And I think there are two or three different ingredients. Well, one is the hydrodynamic interaction. But then that has been discussed a lot in pullers and pushers. But I want to emphasize that I really think that the important part is really the near field and not so much the far field, right? Because I mean the sperm is really close to the wall. I mean this here is the wall, and you see this characteristic pusher
flow field,
yeah, the flow in from the sides and the outflow on the back and in the front, but. This is far from just a dipole, right? So you really have to look at the flow field in more detail. Then it's also steric interaction, but this is an elongated object. So when it comes close to a surface, then it actually stays near the surface, is oriented parallel to the surface. Yeah, so this is, of course, the combination of these two. Yeah, steric interactions and the elongated shape together, I think, are at least as important as the hydrodynamic interactions. And also, it's not that sperm or other objects always stay close to the wall, but they can actually also swim away from the wall. And as an example, I want to show you these figures here. Now, you don't really have to look in detail. I mean, this notation here means that the mid piece is curved, so this part immediately after the head. Yeah, we call this little piece here the mid piece, which is not active and we can curve or not. And so this is the mid piece curved, the tail is elastic, the tail is curved and stiff and so on. But as I said, you don't really have to look at the details. But what you see here is there are three possibilities. Either the head, I mean, this is the trajectory of the head, distance of the head from the wall. So you see in this case, it's really at the wall. That's essentially the movie I showed you. But if the curvature is smaller, you get this rolling motion. Yeah, so you get the sperm is at the wall, but then and it turns, but then it flips, and then therefore as it flips, the head jumps a little bit away from the wall, and then continues jumps away from the wall again, and so on. But this is still at the wall, but then if you look at this blue one here, but then you see that it's actually not staying at the wall, but this is touching the wall, going away, going to the other wall, and so on. But it's clearly not staying at the wall. And I think the reason is, in this case, this is a relatively mildly curved tail. So what it does, it goes to the surface. But then the tail curvature somehow does not really fit together with the wall. So it starts to roll, but the swimming motion is too strong to the hydrodynamic interaction is too weak to keep it at the wall, and therefore it actually goes away from the wall. So I think one also has to take into account that this is a weak interaction. The hydrodynamic interaction is weak with the wall, and the swimming motion is actually quite a strong drive and can easily push it away from the wall again. But that depends on many parameters. So, I mean, I just want to say that it's not so simple to say swimmers are somehow always at the wall. Okay, now, as I say, that I should have done in the beginning. So just want to briefly tell you how we do these simulations. So this is the method which Ray Cabral discussed briefly last week, but which he invented in 1999. And that is a very simple approach to hydrodynamics. It's a particle-based method, the fluid consists of many point particles, and the dynamics proceeds in two steps: a streaming step where the particles are just moving ballistically for some time interval h, and then there's a collision step where the particles are sorted into these little boxes, and then all the particles within one box collide with each other, for example, by a rotation of their relative velocities relative to the center of mass velocity of this particular cell. Yeah, and then if you think of now of this polymer or helix or whatever embedded in this fluid, then what is done is in the streaming step, we just do a molecular dynamic simulation. Yeah? I mean, the polymer in the streaming step as the particles don't see each other, the polymer doesn't see the fluid particles and vice versa. But the polymer particles, monomers, of course, see the other monomers, right? Otherwise, the polymer would just fall apart. So that's where this is a standard MD simulation of a polymer in the streaming step. And in the collision step, the monomers are simply included in these multiparticle collisions. Yeah? So it's just in addition to the whatever 10 fluid particles, there's one polymer monomer, and that participates in this collision step in the same way as all the other fluid particles.
So it's not a discretization of the Navier-Stokes equations, it's a molecular dynamics.
I would also say, I mean, think of it as a molecular dynamic simulation. The interaction is a bit strange, but maybe also not so strange. And the box size you can think of as an interaction range. Yeah, you can say this particle interacts with this one because they are, whatever, have a pair potential which has this range.
So can the speeds of particles change?
The speeds can change.
So
speeds change because you rotate the relative.
The is in the center of mass.
Yeah. I mean, actually, you can start, for example, with all the velocities the same, and then after very few time steps, you have a Maxwell Boltzmann distribution.
So the only really worrisome feature about the simulation, which is the same thing you'd have if you did do a discretization of the Navier-Stokes equation, is that this boxing step creates rotation invariance.
There are two
special.
There's D special directions.
There.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, I would say there are two things which are more worrisome than. I mean, this is true, of course. Well, the first thing, of course, this breaks Galilean invariance, right? No, yeah, I mean, you have a fixed grid, right? And that breaks Galilean invariance. But that is very easy to solve. I mean, that was suggested by Thomas Ely and Daniel Kroll. You can make the shift this grid. And in each step, you can choose a different grid. You say at time step t, this is what I see. Time step t plus h, I shift this by some arbitrary vector. Then the particles can no longer distinguish whether they are moving relative to the grid or whether the grid is moving relative to them. So that restores Galilean invariance. This problem, I would say, is solved. I mean, nobody has ever really looked at this problem with the rotational invariance. I mean, we have tried this.
Yeah, I guess you could do the same thing with rotations, right? The next time
every time
you lay down the grid, just lay it down in an ulterior.
Exactly, but it's just a bit tedious. I mean, that's the reason why nobody has ever done it. I mean, we once had another problem, and we thought that maybe it's related to this rotational invariance. So we tried, didn't see any difference. Therefore, we dropped it again. But I don't want to say that it might still be a problem. Yeah.
I mean, some problems aren't going to be sensitive to whether or not you have rotation invariance. But if you would say you wanted to study the fluid going into some kind of orientation in ordered state, then you'd lose the gold standard if you do this. And if you somehow could restore the rotation invariance, you'd get back.
Yeah. But I mean, another problem which was also mentioned last week is that this does not conserve angular momentum. Yeah, because I mean, you can see this easily, right? I mean, you have a non-local interaction, right? This particle interacts with this one, and you just take two particles, right? Say they are going like this. Yeah, now you rotate their relative velocities. Obviously, angular momentum is not conserved. Again, in many cases, that does not seem to play a big role. And I mean, just as an example, if you take a quad geometry with a cylinder inside, another cylinder outside, and you rotate whatever the inner or the outer one in whatever velocity you like, you get the correct velocity profile between the two cylinders. But what you do not get if you take a fixed torque of, say, the inner cylinder, then you get the wrong rotation velocity. Doesn't matter. There are variants of this where you can restore also the angular momentum conservation.
What's the advantage of this, Phyllis, just doing direct molecular dynamics where none of these words would come up?
Well, the advantage here is that you, first of all, you don't have to calculate any neighbor distances, but all you have to do is sorting. I mean, at time t, you just say, for each particle, I decide in which box it is without knowing where the neighbors are. And then, of course, this multi-particle relation, right, we rotate all of them in the box by the same angle around the same axis. That is also much easier than really doing calculating all the where the particles would hit and so on. I mean, so it's much simply much more efficient, and therefore we can do something like a million fluid particles without much trouble.
This might be too specific a question. Maybe we can talk about it afterwards. But I don't see how you impose viscous boundary conditions with this kind of an approach, like on a wall or on the particles, for example.
Yeah. Let's talk about it after. I mean, as I say, normally we do bound spec. I mean, we is everybody. I mean, in all the different techniques. I mean, the competing techniques is like this Boltzmann or dissipative particle dynamics. But I mean, all of them essentially uses the same idea for the boundary condition. As I say, I'm happy to explain it to you in more detail. Okay, and then, I mean, you can also play a little bit with this method. I heard last week that the website is not really working, and I really didn't want to show it to you, but because we had so many questions, maybe I do it anyway. I mean, I have it here on my computer, so I don't need the website. But in principle, you should be able to do exactly the same thing on the website. I hope it will work again this week. Yeah, so here you see now this is an online simulation. Yeah, you see here the fluid velocities. This is averages over all the particles in one cell. And here you can see three colloidal particles diffusing in these fluids. Yeah, and then now what you can do, or I can do, is you can grab one of the particles by taking the cursor, pull. Yeah, and then you see how the flow field around it develops. And you can also.
2D or 3D?
This is 2D. You see what you get. Yeah, you can also look at the hydrodynamic interactions between them, or you can set them into rotational motion, and so on. As I said, I mean, I think it doesn't work on the website now, but if you want to play, maybe can do it here on my computer afterwards. Okay, so as I said, that was a somewhat lengthy introduction and somewhat lengthy overview of what we have done on the motion of these biological microswimmers. Now, for the rest of my talk, I want to tell you about these things, which I have already talked about 3 weeks ago in the conference. So I want to talk about the collective behavior of self-propelled rods, of self-propelled spheres, and then finally, I hope I have time to look at curved flagella. Okay, so this is motivated by this experiment by in the group of Andreas Bosch, where they take this motility assay, that is a cover slip. You have little motor proteins mounted on top of the cover slip, and then in this case, actin filaments which bind to the motors and then are just pushed forward by the motors. Yeah, and here you can see some snapshot of it, where just some part of the filaments are labeled. So they actually, I mean, this is also indicated here, right? Only part of them are visible, but they are much more than what you see. And then one of the interesting behaviors they found here is this the formation of these density waves. Yeah, you see that there are many fluorescently labeled here, which also indicates that many other non-labeled filaments are here, and then there's these regions, the black regions, where hardly any actin filaments. So, well, I mean, one possibility is to say, okay, let's just consider this as a self-propelled rods, and when the self-propelled rods collide, then they align each other and move in the same direction. But as you may already see here, that there's also a possibility that the actin filaments actually passing over each other or maybe tunneling below each other, so that it's not a strict self-avoidance, but there is some probability for some penetration if you think of it as a two-dimensional model.
So this system is actually
pulled with
the net velocity.
Yes, the particles are certainly moving, I mean, the rods, the filaments are moving in one direction, right? Because the motors are moving in one direction.
But what I'm saying is not only are the particles themselves folded, but the state they go into is folded.
Yes, yes. This is polar density.
More than in this picture moving up and to the right, and more moving down to the left.
This is not the whole system.
Right, but it's a lot of particles in one meeting.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely agree with you. Okay, so what we generalize this model for rods, which we and others have looked at previously, to the case where they can actually pass through each other, penetrate each other. So we have this intrinsic swimming velocity or swimming force. I mean, I think this is the same discussion we had with Hartmut Löwen last week in the same model. Yeah? I mean, it's just a force in the instantaneous direction of the rod, which always pushes the rod forward. But of course, that this direction changes as the rod orientation is changing. And then there's some diffusion in everything. I mean, in translational diffusion, rotational diffusion, and then we have this soft interaction between the rods. And for this, we take this separation shifted Lennard-Jones potential, which becomes a normal Lennard-Jones potential for some parameter alpha equal to zero. So this shoots up, but then as this parameter increases, then the maximum here goes down, and then we use this kind of energy barrier height. This is a shifted potential, right? So forget this attractive tail. We just cut this away and have just a purely repulsive potential. Yeah, and then we can define the standard Peckley number, which is something like the rod length times the velocity over the diffusion constant, just expressed here in terms of this force. And then we can also define another dimensionless number, right? Because if two rods are colliding, then it's not necessarily only the KT, the thermal energy, which is important, but it can also be the interaction energy between two rods, which make them not penetrate through each other. So that is somehow the generalization of the Peckley number to this energy barrier. Yes, that's why we took Q. PQ, yeah. P, yeah. I said this already, but this we treat this thing as a quasi 2D system, right? To just avoid this complication that we really have to look at the passing over or below each other, which makes it much more complicated. Yeah, then.
Sure. So the interaction is implemented between each single sphere on the rod, or it's two rods as two objects.
It's a bead model, right? So it's this kind of shishke, but it's this rod of beads, but the beads are interacting. Each two beads have this Lennard-Jones interaction.
Okay, so if two beads collide in different orientations, the penetrability will be different.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that's actually what you see.
So you're simulating with no hydrodynamics in this model?
In this case, no. This is just a Brownian dynamics model. So this is exactly what I want to discuss here, this dependence on the penetrability on this collision angle. Yeah, so what we do is we look at this situation. Yeah, one rod is pushing forward in this direction, the other one is pushing forward in that direction. We look at this one in the hitting the other one in the middle, and then with this angle phi, and then you can see here the penetrability probability, crossing probability as a function of this angle. Yeah, not surprisingly, this is has a maximum at around 90 degrees, right? Because if this hits right in the middle, then somehow essentially only one bead or a few beads have to cross each other. Whereas if it hits with this very small angle, of course you have a overlap of many beads, and therefore the energy barrier is higher. I mean, you also see that it's not exactly symmetric around 90 degrees, but it's actually shifted a little bit to higher angles. And I think that this becomes this is because the rods are moving. And so as this one comes in here, both of them are moving and slightly aligning, or aligning, and therefore they have a lower probability here, then if when they are actually pushing against each other, right, they turn more towards 90 degrees and have a higher probability for passing. But that's why this is actually shifted to the higher angle side. Yeah, and then here you see this experiment for microtubules. This is from this paper of Somino et al. And these are these open squares. So you see we get a very similar behavior, and that would correspond here to this line here, that we would have an energy barrier of about 2 kT, Pickler number of order 10, and this permeability coefficient of about 5. Okay, then now I have a couple of movies. So this is for different situations. Right here we have this high penetrability. Yeah, you see here the Pickler number is 100, Q is equal 67. Let's just start this. No. Come on. Yeah, I see. I think what's interesting to see is that sometimes clusters hit each other, and from opposite sides. Yeah, here, for example. Yeah, and they're actually going through each other, but still rods become aligned relative to each other. So two clusters become aligned as they go through each other.
Does this system as a whole have a non-zero polarization?
No, this has no polarization. I mean, I think the individual clusters are polarized, but you see that, I mean, some of them are from the left, some of them are from the right. So I think overall, I would say that is has no polarization.
And if I may, that's what I was saying on Friday. That's consistent.
That's why I'm asking.
So you are right, you know, that the picture from Andreas Bausch, it's used as a motivation sort of in a loose sense, because that really is a polar system. I don't think from the structure of the pattern you see in that case.
Right.
Well, this is not.
So what do you think is the difference between that system and this system?
There must be that.
I mean, one is the dynamic interactions, obviously.
So from the point of view of doing models, I mean, usually we think about in terms of three types of models. One is polar particles with interactions that are polar, aligned head to tail. That would be polar system. One is this, which is polar particles with interactions that don't necessarily align head to tail. And then it's really the mapping system. And so the only thing I can say is that perhaps in there are some interactions with the line things, differential.
This model gives us some sort of.
I mean, hyperdynamic interactions would be
that. Perhaps.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, if something's moving this way, it's going to have more of a tendency to make something move that way than it is to make something move the opposite way.
Yeah.
Because you said it doesn't involve the magnetic interaction, but I think it's really
it does align them, but unless the soft rod, maybe Gerard can tell us, but unless the soft rod is different from hard rod in this respect, certainly for hard rod, let's say, the collision tends to align regardless of whether it is a head-to-head or head-to-tail, which is tends to align.
I think this is a pneumatic alignment, but I think it also has a polar component, right? Because I mean, if you think of it as a friction, right? Because I should have maybe said a little bit more. And I mean, this picture is a little bit misleading, because I mean, we put more spheres here than just touching spheres, so that it becomes a smoother potential. Right? That you have not this strong corrugation here, but it's a very small wiggles. But of course, there are still wiggles. So that means when the rods are overlapping, I think they're just pulling along each other to some extent. So therefore, I think there's a little polar component by using such a potential.
There's also, if you go to the next transparency, yeah, the simple fact that that's asymmetrical is a polarity.
But that, I think that goes in the same direction, right? I mean, that in both cases, I think it is because either you say when this B touches here, right, it feels this corrugation here and therefore is pulled along a little bit, or you say when they're overlapping, they're doing the same it's the same argument in the end. So it's always that the potential is not completely smooth, and therefore there's little friction. I'm not sure, I mean, don't pick on me with this friction. But I mean, there's some force which pulls it in the direction of motion. So I think it's somehow a mixture between a pneumatic and a polar. Yeah, yeah.
But you still don't see any mean polarization.
Well, I mean, it's the same. I mean, this is, sorry. This is now the case where the penetrability is really relatively high.
I'm just saying that I can't tell by eye looking at that movie that it's got a mean polarization. I have to actually know if you have done that.
We have done it, but I mean, the problem is, of course, always, right? I mean, this is a finite system. So, I mean, if we see something. Yes. Yes, in principle, yes.
That would require a case.
No, you can look.
Scaling on a state and see what the problem is.
But then you can see.
Well, if you. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I have a question. So if there's a polar interaction, shouldn't they be staggered rather than.
Staggered like this?
What do you mean staggered?
So, naively, if this is plus and minus, right? They want to be like this, not plus, plus, and minus.
So no, they see each other. I mean, this is a short range interaction. They see each other only when they are really kind of hitting each other. When they're swimming in parallel, I think they feel essentially no force.
Towards each other.
Towards or away from each other, right? I mean, okay, they will repel each other until the Lennard-Jones potential decays to zero. But this is quote short range, right? So therefore they will swim in parallel and not see each other, then of course they have some noise in the rotational direction, so they will hit each other a little bit, but that will just repel them again, so they will just continue to swim in the same direction. And if they swim in opposite direction, right, then again, I mean, either they just don't see each other, right, and I think that is the reason why you see here sometimes these penetrations. Just a second. Where is it? Yeah, here, right? And so they just go essentially through each other because, I mean, they have weak interactions and they can just avoid each other in this two-dimensional space. So they just go through each other.
In our gold platinum rods, what we do see is that when they are aligned, they are actually staggered. And also they stay aligned longer if they're moving in the same direction because you don't get to go.
Let's take a look maybe at the next movie. Secret.
These classes always move left to right.
Man, that is probably the effect of parity boundary conditions. And I mean, because I mean, what goes out here comes back here. So if they align in this direction by chance, but then of course they will somehow, this will favor to keep this alignment at least for a while. And I mean, this is long simulations, right? So it's difficult for us to go much bigger and also to run it much longer. It's parity boundary condition in both directions, yeah, x and y. Okay, let's go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the interesting thing to do would be to look at the probability distribution of the orientation. The velocities, and if that's not isotropic, then either you're going into some kind of voided state. That says at least your system is not very big compared to the orientational correlation.
May not be there.
Actually, you can almost see by eye because those clusters certainly have orientational order, and they're spanning an appreciable kind of system.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, as I say, I mean, the only problem is I can't remember how many rod this is, but it's already somehow a non-trivial simulation. It's difficult to go a factor whatever 10 bigger in size. No doubt about it. I mean, this is, I mean, the same of course holds in this case. Yeah, so this is now at a small penetrability. So these are like essentially like hard rods.
Yeah, and
as you see, the glasses are forming relatively quickly, and then they align more and more. and then after a while, yeah, I mean, you see this band, and this is the colors are the orientations. Yeah, so I should have mentioned this in the beginning. Yeah, so everything moving in this direction is red. Everything moving in that direction is blue, and so on.
So eventually, this system is breaking up into polar clusters that contain an appreciable fraction of all particles in the system.
Yes. So I mean, I would say, I mean, this is clearly polar now, right? Because you see everything is red. I mean, if there would be other ones moving in the opposite direction, then you would see them by color. So because this is red, everything moving in the same direction, clearly polar. And of course, density here is much bigger than the density over here.
In fact, is it fair, is my eye misleading me, or are most of the particles in the system in that cluster?
Almost all of them are in the cluster, yes.
So it's similar to the phase definition that occurs even in the absence of any alignment. Yeah? I mean, it's phase separation.
But now it's phase separation between all the order states.
And by the way, this is really different from Bausch's waves.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, our hope was by introducing this penetrability. I mean, this was known for impenetrable rods, that they would form these large clusters. We were hoping that by taking this penetrability, that we actually may be able to get these density waves, which Andreas Bosch saw. But I mean, okay, that was a complete failure in the sense of explaining this or understanding this Bosch experiment.
But I do want to comment on this, though.
Sure.
If you take the hydrodynamic equations for a polar flock and you add to them at a sort of hydrodynamic level, at a phenomenological level, terms that would tend to give you phase separation, you find you can get a variety of different kinds of stable droplets. And one of the droplets you can get is exactly this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a band of high density that has polar order that's moving parallel to the surface of the band, surrounded by a gas phase, a low density gas phase that's disordered. So this is exactly one of the things you see in a hydrodynamic description.
In the experiment, the penetrability of the distribution, it has some deep in the 120 degree.
Yeah.
What is that?
No idea. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was just taking this as a measurement error bar, but I have no idea. I mean, I cannot really imagine that something really, really is happening at this point. Okay, so what? So
probably just going back to the item before that. How can we increase the penetrability? You lower it, it becomes polar. The direction becomes polar. So before you have any magnetic here,
yeah, that's really a good question. I mean, I have the feeling, and it comes partially from the discussions with Eric Bertin and Christina last week, that when two rods are hitting each other, right? I mean, this is still a rod of a finite aspect ratio. So what I could imagine is that when two, let's say we are in this state right now, a rod comes like this, then it's somehow expelled from the cluster because it's somehow bouncing into this quote wall, or if it's going like this, then it's just pulled along. Yeah, so it's probably the finite aspect ratio which brings in another kind of interaction which is not taken into account. Maybe it's there if you take this attractive interaction, but that's somehow preventing particles from actually moving against each other, right? Because they are somehow blocking each other when they hit head on. That could be a reason why in such a dense state it's unfavorable to really have this pneumatic alignment. Okay, so so here we have this the density of this low density region, right? So what you see is first it has some number when the state is essentially homogeneous, then it drops very quickly as this phase separation becomes more important. Yeah, so the you have this very dense cluster, and then this gas around it, which has a very low density. But then, as the Peclet number increases, means as the force increases on the rods, at some point one reaches this threshold where the penetrability becomes important, and then the cluster starts to disappear again, and the whole thing mixes. Yeah, so this is what we call this clustering window. Yeah, and then you can also look at which where is this critical Q, where this the upper side of the clustering window ends, and then you see that this is pretty constant and consistent with this red line, which is just determining the just comparing forces. Yeah, and just as say you have the force due to the repulsive interaction and the forward pulling force, and that if they are equal, then this determines this red line. Okay, so that is just a picture. I can show you the movie. This is for myxobacteria in the group of Igor Armstrong, and you can see here also that there are these polar clusters. They also collide and partially penetrate through each other. So I think that is probably the closest experiment I'm aware of, which looks very much like what we see here in the simulations. We have also looked at cluster size distributions, yeah, and then, I mean, as other people have seen before, I mean, there's this, let me say, effective power law for not too large cluster sizes with an exponent on the order of minus 1.6 minus 2. Don't really look at this one because this is the giant cluster, right? You see here that the blue ones are where you have a phase separation, giant cluster, whatever you say. You see here's this giant cluster, and of course then there's just a few particles left, small clusters left. So I think it makes not much sense in this case really to fit an exponent. And this exponent order minus 2, that is actually quite nicely consistent with experiments on the myxobacteria. Fernando Peruani has done this comparison in detail, and actually he finds a very nice agreement. And we really have no, I mean, for this question, this penetrability really makes no big change. And then for high density, then we have this pneumatic state. What we also can call laning. So again, the particles are aligning, but now they have this pneumatic alignment. Yeah, where you see the dark blue particles moving down to the right, and the light blue particles moving up to the left.
One might actually be tempted to call that a symmetric structure. I mean, it's not very well wooded right now.
I mean, this is the direction of a line.
Yeah, this is a phase that's also been seen in simulations of point-like particles at higher density by Chate and company. Mm-hmm. And this is a public work involved in it. But it's a kind of symmetric because it's got a periodic structure going from lower left to upper right. I mean, this is internally well ordered, but
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you mean. So you mean that it could be whatever light, dark, and so on in a symmetric ordering.
Right. That is symmetric order. It's a weird. It's like a symmetric C because the orientation of the particles is not perpendicular to the layers, but it's an extreme case. It's where the orientation of the particles are parallel.
Mm-hmm.
So we've actually given that a name for what it's worth, but it's a different phase.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, this is. I'll show you the phase diagram in a second. I think we only see this really in the hypernet. But yeah, okay, just a second. So I think the summary of all of this is this phase diagram. Right? We call this here giant cluster. We could just as well call it phase separation. But so what I'm showing here, right? So this is the density in terms of rod length squared. So one means that the particles start to overlap. And here's the Peclet number, but of course you have to keep in mind that this is for a fixed penetrability. So as the Peclet number increases, and this is just the rescaled velocity axis. So as the Peclet number increases, also Q increases, and at some point you get the penetrability. So to answer your question here is actually I have to look at it in more detail. So this picture is somewhere out here. And I don't really know exactly, I don't have a picture in my mind how it looks here, but I mean, that is easy to check. Yeah, and then this is this region where we see the small clusters or the interpenetrating clusters, that's what I showed you as the first movie.
So that's the region of the panel spectrum and cluster
sizes? This one, yeah. I mean, here in the giant cluster or the phase separation, I mean, you have hardly any clusters, right? So that is this region where this is a high exponent, but I think you can just about fit an exponential. I mean, it makes not much sense for these few clusters here on the order, right? I mean, here we have only 10 particles in the cluster. And here I would say it has more credibility, right? I mean, here you can have at least up to about 100 particles in the cluster. Okay, so that's all I have to say about rods. Now I want to say a little bit about. Okay. Maybe Sigrid should just stop me. Maybe I go through this a little quicker. I would like to say at least a few words also about these curved particles. So very briefly, and I mean we have heard this by other talks in other talks before. So these are these self-Gaussianus colloids, spherical. Colloids on a surface, and there has been quite a number of publications, maybe more, which see essentially the same thing, that if with propulsion these particles order into a crystalline structure, and then when the propulsion is switched off, you see that the clusters are falling apart. It shows that this is not due to some attractive interaction between the particles. It's really the propulsion mechanism which drives them into these clusters. Now, as I say, this is 2D. Now we wanted to see what happens actually in 3D. And the interesting point about the spheres compared to the rods, which I showed you before, is that they have no alignment interaction. So the rods collide, but the rotational diffusion of the rods is assumed to be completely independent of the orientation of the neighbors. So the rotation is just doing a Brownian diffusion always, whether it's in the fluid or in the gas or in the crystalline phase, always just a Brownian rotation. So there's no alignment mechanism, just orientational diffusion. This is again just Brownian dynamics.
Each
sphere independently, but then of course when they collide they stop. You know, I mean there's a hardcore repulsion, essentially a hardcore repulsion between the particles, but it does not affect the rotational diffusion. Okay, so that's what we find. We find a phase separation, which has been seen and predicted by others. My case particular has been active in this region, so in this field. So what? not in this region. In this, yeah. Okay. So what you see here is a droplet. Red is the inside of the droplet. Green is outside. So the high density is in red part, and then green is to the gas side. And then as the density, so this is quote low density, but still a volume fraction 0.35 or so. This is at a higher density, you see something like a bicontinuous structure, and then at very high density, you just see these kind of gas droplets inside the fluid phase. And the important point is that in this case, we find that the dense phase is actually a fluid to very high density, as you will see in a second. So therefore, the dynamics in this high density phase is completely different from the two-dimensional case. And this I explained to you already. Maybe I can also mention that I mean Christina has this model of soft spheres in two dimensions, which can then also somehow penetrate through each other or pass each other, and then the behavior in 2D actually becomes similar or related to what we see in three dimensions.
Yeah, but they were also polys.
So if you suppress, the crystallization in 2D, then the behavior becomes more similar to 3D. I mean, I don't want to claim that it's the same or different. We don't just don't know. Yeah, but it looks much more similar.
Which is true in Olympia too.
Okay, so this is what we find. This is kind of a local order parameter, a local density, and this here is the global volume fraction. So what you see is at low densities, you just see that the local density increases in the same way as the global density increases. And then at some point, you see this phase separation into a very high density phase. And please note that this is a density of 0.62, 0.63. So that's actually higher than the glass density in three-dimensional equilibrium. And here then is this gas phase with a very low density. And what we can do here, as we go through this transition, we can look at the interface properties. So this is the mean integrated mean curvature. That's the area of the interface. And this here is the Euler characteristic, which all indicate essentially the same thing, right? I mean, first, you have no droplets. Therefore, there is no area. Then many small droplets are forming. That's why the area increases rapidly. Then the droplets merge together, form bigger clusters or bigger aggregates. The area comes down again. And then finally, everything is filled with a fluid, only a few gas bubbles, and then everything is filled with fluid.
So how do you define
interface? I mean, we do a Voronoi construction, and then adjust essentially an area to each particle. That's how we define this local area fraction. And then we just make a histogram and make a cut somewhere in between. I can't remember exactly. I mean, so somewhere in here, say 0.4 or 0.35 or so, as a threshold between the gas phase and the liquid phase.
So every particle by that construction is defined either in gas or liquid.
Yeah. And then this is how we get this. And so this is just the level surfaces of this density field.
So the area is just the sum of the areas of the faces of all Voronoi particles.
No, the area. Exactly.
The
area
particle is in the one phase.
Exactly. Yeah. And in this way, we can define. If we have the interface defined, then of course you can just do this geometrical analysis of all these quantities. Yeah. And then, I don't have to go through it, right? I mean, you say the same here, right? First it's no droplets, then the droplets, small droplets start to form, they come together, the curvature goes down again, then you have inverse droplets because they're now surrounding the gas phase, and then they come to zero again, and the same you see in the Euler characteristic. Okay, so I think the main interesting point from our from our point of view is the dynamics. Yeah. So if you now look at the collective dynamics of these many particles, then this is what we see. Yeah, so what you see that actually pretty large swirls forming, and not only pretty large, I mean essentially as large as the system size, right? I mean this is the whole system, so we see a swirl which involves most of the particles in the system. So this is at lower density.
And does that scale up? If I look at the system,
it seems, I mean, at least over the range of system sizes we can do, it seems to scale with the system size. And so this is at low density. This here is at higher density. Yeah, and again, you see a similar behavior. Essentially, the whole system is involved. There are large regions. Like here, there's a band of motion which involves somehow all the particles. Yeah, and our interpretation is here. It's a little more difficult to argue, but maybe here it's more easier. Here you see this kind of band forming, this jet forming, and I mean our feeling is the following. This is due to particles are sorted here at the interface, right? Because if you think of a particle which is sitting here, then it's preferentially oriented towards the fluid phase, right? It's moving in the gas, it's hitting the surface, therefore it has a high probability to push into the fluid. And then, so there should be a layer, we call it a protective layer of particles at the interface, which are all pushing into the fluid. And then, now of course, they still have the rotational diffusion, so this is the interface, right? So it's rotating. Let me take this one. So it's rotating like this. At some point, it can start to move, and it's essentially parallel to the interface. Right? Then it starts to move, but then it's caught. Right? It's caught here in these regions, which are highly curved, because there are more rotation is necessary because before it can move out. Right? If it's like this, then it has to actually rotate further before it can start to move. So therefore, we think that particles with high polarity are collecting in these regions, and then they are actually pushing forward and setting the whole thing into motion. I don't know why this is all this.
Flies in the face in an interesting way with everything we've been saying about what kind of interactions you need to get a polar state. Because if you imagine, you can't do this simulation, obviously, but imagine you simulate that, the gap goes into particles, and you got the same kind of structure on that scale. Okay. So now I cut a piece out of this here that contains a billion particles, and it's a polar state. That I can essentially make as polar as I want.
Yeah.
It's coming out of a set, out of a model that has no aligning interactions whatsoever.
I mean, that's why I mean, personally, I have the feeling it cannot really persist for forever. Right? I mean, this. Now, this is already quite big, yes. As I say, okay, let me just show the next. Why this is stuck already again? Ah, come on. Ah, okay. No. Okay, I skip this. Right, so we can look at these kind of correlation functions. Yeah, so we can look at this displacement correlation function, which is this defined as particle at time, here. Right, we define this displacement vector as particle position at time t plus delta t minus the particle position at time t. We can also look at the as a kind of a orientation correlation function. And interestingly, this shows a much stronger, more pronounced structure than the orientation correlation function. And I think the reason is that if you go back to this picture, this picture here, right, then you can say if such a region has formed here and it's pushing forward, then because the particles are all polarly ordered, then the particles here don't have to be polar ordered actually, right? I mean, they're just pointing in arbitrary direction, but because there's this crowd pushing forward, the others are just pushed ahead, although they are not pointing in the same direction. I mean, it's yeah, okay, we can. Oh yeah, that's what I wanted to show you. So here, right? So this is this. Not, I can show you the polar. I don't have it here, but I can show it to you. So this is just the displacement correlation function for these different for this range of system sizes. Yeah, from 13 to 52, and then you see, and this is R over L, and you see that all of them essentially fall onto the same line. So at least in this range of sizes, you find that they all essentially fall onto the same curve. And that would indicate that the correlations are actually long range, that is somehow indicated by here by this dashed line where we would say in the limit L to infinity, but L to infinity really is a courageous statement. Yeah, so large L, larger L, it could become more and more like a power law decay. Yeah, and then here we have this kind of integrated correlation function, and you also see that first of all, times here are still in on the range. So what this shows, this is this integrated correlation function here. Right, somehow something like a susceptibility, and it shows that first of all, it takes a while until the maximum correlations form. Right, so in the beginning, particles are just somehow rattling in their cage, and then only after a while have these coherent streams formed, then you get this peak, and then of course they decay at some point. And that becomes also more pronounced as the system size increases. Well, that is not such a big surprise because just more particles are involved.
So I think I'm a little bit puzzled by why is there this local orientation or polar polarity when there's no line interaction? Or is there any dissipation in this collision? No? Not at all?
No. But let's talk about it. Let me just finish this, and I mean, I skip my. This was Peclin number 270. Yeah, this is large. Yes, I agree with you. But let me just finish this, and then I stop, and then we can talk. Just a little review of the talk. So here you see then the phase diagram, and that is quite similar to what Christina saw in 2D in this polydispersed soft spheres. And so we see this region here is this kind of a two-phase region. That means everywhere here we see the separation into this low density phase and the fluid phase. Down here below a Peclin number of around 30, we see no phase separation. So there's a minimum Peclin number needed to get phase separation. And then out here, there's still a small patch, of small region where the phase actually crystallizes. Yeah, so you see that this, of course, at very low Peclin number, this is essentially the normal crystal gas as crystal fluid coexistence, but then this shifts to higher density, and then there's still a window in between where you have the fluid phase before you reach the crystalline phase.
Do you understand that? I mean, we have the same thing, but we don't quite understand why.
Okay, then I skip this, I guess. My time is already a bit progressed. And let me just conclude. I think that is now kind of common knowledge that the shape, the orientational fluctuation, and the hydrodynamics together determine the clusters, the collective dynamics of these microswimmers. That this is aggregation and clustering is a quite generic feature of self-propelled particles that is seen for many different systems. For penetrable rods, we saw these motile polar clusters and the pneumatic laning phase. For the Brownian spheres, we see the phase separation and the collective dynamics. And for, that maybe I can skip behind that. I've not really been able to talk about. But if you are interested to hear more, then I'm happy to tell you about it. Okay, sorry that it took so long. Thanks a lot.
Assumption that the
velocities
work, I think it's wrong. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
So what you basically said is that when they're propelled, you form phases, and when they're not propelled, then they don't form phases, and therefore there is no interaction between them. But the propulsion and interaction come together. When they're propelled, there's a chemical reaction, and you create a gradient.
Yeah.
It's a gradient that brings them together. So
no, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I should have been more careful about stating this. Yeah.
But the simulation showed you can get the phase separation back.
So I didn't understand. So these are Janus particles that you're looking at? When you say the Brownian?
No, they are just spheres.
Well, they're not totally symmetrical, are they?
Well, they are not. Well, I mean, in the simulation.
No, you're just imposing the simulation that each one of them carries an orientation that no one can see.
Exactly.
And that orientation is both diffusible, and it moves in the direction.
Mine, for the interaction, it's just the hard sphere.
Well, simulations show that if you just have repulsion and sub propulsion, you can set phase direction. What these experiments see is not phase separation. They see cluster formation, the cluster at the final side, the total recoil. Simulations also have shown that you get that, you also need some attraction.
So if you have...
So the attraction actually makes the cluster
catch up.
The attraction
actually, right.
Exactly.
So it's...
I mean, the bulk of these Palachi experiments are the low density. But even at these low densities, you see this prolonged spiking in cluster. For this, you get either small scale or fraction or small length scale, or you basically use it for...
Right, so that's what I'm saying. So there is a lot on that kind of region of some kind of diffusion-purging interaction.
Yeah. But I think...
I mean, we have seen
that.
I think David is saying that the light-triggered box type of action is on
Yeah, I mean, I would also say, I mean, if you look at these clusters, I mean, there's a strong indication for me that there must be some effective attractive interaction, because you hardly ever see particles leaving the cluster, right? I mean, if we just have a rotational diffusion, I mean, there should be some probability that some of them just decides to go in the other direction, but that is hardly ever happening. So I think that is a